Hello and welcome to Musings on Golf. And if I sound a little bit pumped up, well, you know what? All of us who care deeply about the great game of golf should be fired up, as the 44th Ryder Cup is a mere 2 days away. My name is Kelly Elbin, along with my co-host and good friend Bob Bupka. And Bob, we've waited a long, long time for those first tee chants and those first tee jitters. 2 days away, very early on in the States, Friday morning, first ball's going up in the air, the Ryder Cup. It doesn't get much better than that in golf.
Well, you're right about that, Kelly. And I'm really excited because having you as the co-host and with your background with the PGA of America, your dad, Max, president yeah. for a long, long time, you actually caddied in the Ryder Cup for Lee Trevino. I would say there's nobody in America more excited about the upcoming Ryder Cup because you know so much about it. You have experienced it. And I think we're in for a Jim Dandy here in Italy.
Much like you, Bob, I've had a lot of great golf experiences. None compares to the 2014 Ryder Cup at Glen Eagles in Scotland, the first tee that Friday morning. And the first groups coming through the tunnel there, walking up to the first tee, the chants from the Europeans, so creative, so much fun. Goosebump City. It was off the charts, amazing. And then the Europeans went out and got it done. It's truly an event unlike any other. And it's such a global event, Bob, and has been for some time. Going to be really interesting to see how the U.S. reacts after really pummeling the Europeans 2 years ago at Whistling Straits, and how the Europeans come back after that, after getting kicked in the rear end 2 years ago.
Yeah, well, first off, I got to hand it to Team Europe. They have this golf course set up. The spectators area is absolutely incredible. They can accommodate 50,000 spectators a day. Tickets are sold out. I did a little quick math there, Mr. Elbin, and 50,000 a day for 3 days, that's about $30 million. So it's not only a big event, it's a big event financially for both the European PGA and the U.S. PGA, and you know, so many people behind the scenes doing such great work. Certainly, we want to wish the best of luck to Julius Mason, representing the United States squad, and he's left no detail unturned. So, from our vantage point, best of luck, USA. From a golf lover standpoint, let's have it close. Let's have it come down to the wire, much like the Solheim Cup last week.
Yeah, Julius, my boss at the PGA in my days there, a longtime liaison with the captain, done a great job through the years, has a lot going on this week. Bob, let's before we get to Ryder Cup, Solheim Cup was really dramatic and being played in Spain. And the only player on the from Spain, Carlota Segunda, comes through, clinches the point that gains the tie, and kudos to the Europeans for retaining the cup. It ends in a tie. Hey, by the way, what do you think? Are you a fan at all of going to a playoff, if you would, to so you wouldn't have a tie at the end? I personally am not, but I'm interested in your thoughts.
Well, I agree with you. I think there should be some reward for being the defending champion. And that reward manifests itself in the fact that if the winning team, the previous event, gets a tie in the next event, they retain the cup. I think that's perfect. Let's not fool with it. No adjustments necessary.
I agree. Both sides knew what they had to get to as far as points coming into the week. And look, the U.S. played really well. The Europeans just a little bit better when it mattered in those singles down the stretch. By the way, the Solheim Cup turns right around because of COVID. It was played this year, but then it gets back to even number years starting next year at Robert Trent Jones Golf Club outside of D.C. So Marcus Simone Golf and Country Club, Bob, a golf course that hosts the Italian Open and now hosts golf's biggest event. It looks to be set up to be a great match play venue. Par 72, about 6,600 yards. You're going to see a lot of birdies. You're going to see a lot of drama. down the stretch, you've got a drivable par four, the 16th hole. I think it's a golf course that's set up perfectly for the Europeans, that heavy rough, tight fairways, just the way it's been for them. And by the way, we talked about this 30-year dry spell with the U.S. not winning. Fact of the matter is, recently in Europe, it hasn't been close. I mean, 2018 in Paris, the Europeans won 17.5 to 10.5. 2014 in Scotland, which I mentioned, the Europeans won 16.5 to 11.5. The U.S. They got a lot of work. They got their work cut out for them, Bob, in my opinion.
Absolutely, and I was asked on another outlet that I cover the Ryder Cup for, Talk Sport, out of London, the world's largest sports radio station, who was the favorite. And I said, I think, beyond any question of a doubt, the European side is the favorite in this upcoming match. I mean, when I look at that, you know, top of the board for Team Europe, Rory McIlroy, John Rahm, Victor Hovland, Matt Fitzpatrick, I mean, unbelievable. And the one captain's pick that I think is going to do really well, Tommy Fleetwood. He could very well be the star of the show.
The great Tony Jacklin, four-time European Ryder Cup captain, will be our guest shortly here on Musings on Golf. And we talked with Captain Jacklin last week, and he was the one who really began to elevate the sense of pride into what the Ryder Cup meant for the European side. And really set off what has been a dominant period for the Europeans. Here's an interesting statistic. The U.S. has lost the last six Ryder Cup played in Europe by an average of 4.3 points. That's a lot, considering there's only 28 points available. And I noted statistically, Luke Donald has made the decision to start with foursomes or alternate shot on Friday morning, because they've shown to the Europeans have quite the edge over the U.S. in alternate shot over the years. Fast starts, Bob. That's what they want. Obviously, would love to see that for the Americans as well. But things are going to get going quickly. You only got one ball in play for each team on Friday morning. A lot of action right away.
Yeah, good point there, Kelly. And you know, that's why the first couple of matches on Friday, you say, well, it's only Friday. But somehow momentum has demonstrated to be an important factor in Ryder Cup, maybe more so than almost any other event I know. So if you can get it going in your favor, it seems a lot easier to continue on those winning ways than if you get behind the eight ball early. The pressure ramps up a little bit and the performances are not as great. So all I hope for is great golf, a compelling finish, and a nice celebration of another Ryder Cup well played.
Teams that have the lead after the first session, the Friday morning session in the Ryder Cup, have won 70% of the Ryder Cup. So talking about getting off to that fast start, it's huge. You've worked a lot of Ryder Cups. I gave my sense of what it's like on a first tee. From your perspective, Bob, it's just for people who haven't attended a Ryder Cup, whether in the States or overseas, it is so very different from even a major championship, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And the best description that I can come up with, Kel, just imagine all the planning that goes into effect in planning a wedding and how the bride feels. The morning of the day of the wedding ceremony, she wakes up. She's not used to these feelings. She's been single her whole life. Now she's going to be married later on in the day. She can't wait for it to have the ceremony complete. That's what it's like for these Ryder Cup players. When they wake up Friday morning, and many will wake up probably 2 to 3 hours before their normal wake-up time, they will not know what to do. They feel very uncomfortable. They know it's going to be an exciting moment. Many a Ryder Cup player has said to me in person, it's the hardest tee shot they ever hit, their first shot in Ryder Cup competition.
Yeah, and that comes from guys who have won major championships and guys who have been there in all other types of pressure-packed situations. Okay, so Bob, 2 years ago at Whistling Straits, as we mentioned, the U.S. really dominated. And it was an unusual Ryder Cup as well because of COVID. There really weren't that many European fans in attendance. The U.S. won 19-9. I want to get your pick on this. As much as I would love to see the U.S. win, I just see the likes of Hovland, who, by the way, neither Hovland nor Matt Fitzpatrick have won a match in Ryder Cup competition. I think I see that changing. I see the Europeans winning this 15-13. It will come down again, I think. Therefore, it will come down to late in the day on Sunday with the singles. I just think there's a little bit of an intangible there that gives the Europeans an edge. I know that Captain Jacklin will be watching, and he would be thrilled to see them continue that dominance and extend it beyond 30 years of not losing on home soil.
You know, you just look at Team Europe, the top three. Any one of those could be this year's star. Rory McIlroy, John Rahm, Victor Hovland. I mean, that is a powerful starting three. Whereas the U.S., they have Cantley, certainly a good player. Schauffele, a good player. Wyndham Clark, reigning U.S. Open champion. But I just can't see Cantley, Schauffele, and Clark holding up against McIlroy, Rahm, and Hovland.
I think they'll hold up, if you will, but I just think there's that edge. I think you will see a start. I wouldn't be surprised if the Europeans won three of the four matches on Friday morning. So do you ultimately give the edge to the Europeans to get the Ryder Cup back?
I have to make them the favorites. But favorites don't always win. That's why they race. We'll wait and see. I want an exciting competition. I want good-spirited outcomes from the galleries that are going to be there. I mean, it's going to be packed to the rafters. I mean, this golf course accommodates 50,000 spectators. I mean, that's magnificent. A lot of rolling hills that provide excellent vantage points. So I think the golf course is going to do its job. And as Tony Jacklin said, momentum is everything. Get off to a good start, guys, and then you're well on your way to victory. And what an honor and pleasure it was to have Tony Jacklin join us on Musings on Golf. Four-time European Ryder Cup captain. Fantastic gentleman. It was a thrill being able to spend time with Tony Jacklin. I know our listeners are going to really enjoy that interview we had with him just recently.
Last act, a real gentleman, and really, he's the in so many ways. Yes, they had the beginning of great players in the early 80s coming along when all of Europe came in, but he was the guiding hand. He was the one who set the stage and really empowered the team, the European side, to begin its dominant run. And you'll hear from Captain Tony Jacklin right after this.
The all-new Pro V1 and Pro V1X are designed to outperform. Created in Titleist R&D laboratories, manufactured in Titleist golf ball plants, and then validated by the best players in the world. These golf balls are longer and more consistent with unrivaled control. Outperform with the new Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X.
Welcome back to Musings on Golf. Bob, the 44th Ryder Cup is just days away from starting in Rome. And our special guest today knows all about playing in and leading his team into the biennial matches. Seven times he represented Great Britain and Europe as a player. And for an unprecedented four consecutive Ryder Cups, he was the captain as Europe began to turn the Ryder Cup in its favor. World Golf Hall of Fame member, Captain Tony Jacklin, welcome to Musings on Golf.
It's nice to be with you. I'm obviously looking forward to our little chat.
Tony Jacklin, I've covered this sport for a long time, and I've had the pleasure of meeting a lot of nice people involved in the sport, and I met a lot of talented people in the sport. I can honestly say that you, Tony, represent not only being very talented, but being very nice and kind to the media and for all media members everywhere. And I thank you for helping us do our job as best we can by your cooperation. You know, and I got to start off, Tony, by asking you, growing up in England, when did you start learning about the Ryder Cup, and how important was it to golfers and the general public throughout Great Britain?
The Ryder Cup was, I knew about it from an early age. 1957, the matches came to Lindrick in Yorkshire, which was not far from where we lived in Lincolnshire. And I'd just taken the game up, and it was an opportunity to see the world's best players, some of the world's best players. And my dad took me over there, and it was a fantastic experience for me. It was an inspiration. I was 13 years old, and I went to the club that evening. I can still remember it. I went to the local club that evening, having been at Lindrick all day, and shot the best nine holes of my life to that point. So I was very involved with it. Little did I know that just 10 years after that, I would have my first Ryder Cup experience in 1967 in Houston. So it was an exciting time for me. That,
Tony, you just referenced 1967 Champions Golf Club in Houston. What was it like for you on that first tee of your first match?
Well, it was pretty scary, actually. We had the flag raising was on the morning of the first day, so we went through the flag raising ceremony and basically straight onto the first tee, and I was in the first group, and legs were shaking a bit, and I'm not sure where the first shot went, but I didn't whiff it. It was a nerve-wracking experience, obviously. Ben Hogan was the US captain, of course, and Di Reese was our captain. I was very fond of Di Reese. He was a good guy, and played a lot of golf with him. And it was an incredible experience for, a 23-year-old. And it was a big learning curve. There was we put a few points on the board. I must say I had a partnership. I played in the foursomes and four ball with Dave Thomas, who was a big, great driver of the ball, Dave. And we put a few points on the board, but I think Arnold beat me in the singles beat me one up in the singles, but it was a great learning experience for me, and thoroughly enjoyed it, obviously.
We are honored to be joined by four-time Ryder Cup captain Tony Jacklin here on Musings on Golf. And Tony, from your perspective, would you do us all a favor, just kind of walk us through those final few holes of your singles match with Jack at the 69 Ryder Cup at Royal Birkdale. It's become known as the concession and has been heralded for so many years. What I'm wondering from your perspective, what was the pressure like for you that day leading up to that, Jack giving you that putt on 18?
Well, there was a lot of pressure. I mean, I'd won the Open a couple of months before, and I'd been told that I needed to come back and play in America, immediately after that by Mark McCormack, who was managing me. And of course, I was completely done after the Open win. And I came to America for 3 or 4 weeks and missed the cut every week because I was wiped out. But by the time, September came, I got my sort of breath back, if you like. And I went into the Ryder Cup playing some good golf. And the format wasn't what it is today. And it's very significant, I think, for people that follow the matches, that for a long time, they messed with the formula. In 57, when Dairese's team won at Lindrick, there were only eight players on each team.
Yeah.
And the upshot of it was America had much more strength and depth than the Great Britain and Ireland had. And they were always searching for a format to try and make it a bit fairer, if you like. And anyway, we played two singles in 69. I played Jack in the morning in singles, and then we played again in the afternoon. And so he wasn't on his best form. I beat him in the morning at 4-3, which obviously was pleasing for me. But the afternoon, he was a bit sharper somehow, and it was nip and tuck. There was never more than a hole in it. And we got to the 16th, and I dropped a shot. I failed to get up and down for a par there and went one down. 17 was a long par five. We both hit the green in two, but I was 50 feet away, and he was about 20 feet. And I hold this 50-footer, which was, you know, a fluke. I say a fluke. I mean, you're trying to make a putt, but, you know, for it to go in those circumstances was unbelievable. And, of course, the crowd, big roar of the crowd and all the rest of it. I think the players around the 18th green ahead of us thought that I'd beaten Jack. He missed his 20-footer, and, of course, we come onto the last square. And it's not where you want to be, I can tell you that, because, you know, the result of the match is reliant on your game. But we both hit good tee shots on the last hole, and I sort of raced off ahead of him, and he hollered after me. He caught me up, and we were walking along together, and he said, "How are you feeling?" I said, "I'm petrified." He said, "I just thought I'd ask, because if it's any consolation, I feel just the same way as you do, you know." And there we were, you know, all our teammates around the green waiting to see what the outcome was going to be. And we actually both hit good shots. I was past the pin about maybe 30 feet, and he was inside me. He was about maybe 20 feet away, again, similar distance to what he was on 17. And I hit my putt, you know, not a bad putt. I mean, the greens were less than perfect in those days. And I hit it 20 inches to 2 feet. That's Jack's reckoning, and we've talked about it many times, obviously. And I marked it, and he had this 20-footer to win the thing outright for America. And he took a rush at this putt, and it must have gone five and a half feet by. It was too far past to sort of, you know, to say good, you know, let's pick him up, because it was a very missable putt he had. And of course, like the great player he is, he studied it and knocked it in the back of the hole. And in the same, as he picked his ball out of the hole, he picked my marker up, which was a shocker for me. I mean, I was stood there thinking, TJ, no matter what happens, you're going to have to make this putt. And, you know, I don't know. I think I might have made it. I never know, because I was shocked. I was relieved. And, you know, half match was, everybody was ecstatic. There was a lot going on, and it was a wonderful sporting moment, a gesture. You know, we played our hearts out. We were trying to beat each other's brains out, as you do on a golf course, but it was never a war. You know, it was always kept in perspective. And and of course it went down as a concession, and it was a really watershed moment in Ryder Cup history, and it's still remembered to date. I mean, 30 years on from there, you know, we built a golf course together here in Florida, and it turned out a tremendous test of golf as well. Far too difficult for me to play anymore.
Indeed, the concession club that you and Jack built has hosted a number of big-time events. And that relationship, Tony, I don't know how well you really knew Jack before that moment in 69, but that relationship it really blossomed and continues to this day, doesn't it?
No, it did, yeah. I mean, and, you know, when I got my tour card in 67, I went to Palm Beach Gardens to do that. And, of course, Jack lives right there, and we did a lot of fishing, and we got to know each other much better. I played with him in 66, or against him, in the World Cup in Japan. He was partnered by Arnold Palmer. I was partnered by Peter Alice. And so, you know, we knew each other fairly well, but we certainly had a healthy respect for each other's game anyway.
Yeah. And joined by four-time European Ryder Cup captain, Tony Jacklin, here on Musings on Golf. Tony, you were a participant at the 79 Ryder Cup at the Greenbrier in West Virginia. And it really heralded the start of the Ryder Cup as we know it today, with players from all of continental Europe first competing for that beautiful little chalice. Had you been lobbying for adding the likes of Seve and others from continental Europe to the Great Britain and Ireland team at that time?
Well, it wasn't really me. I mean, it was Jack who wrote a letter, actually. I mean, we got tired of getting beat, really. I mean, and 77 at Lytham, as I said earlier, they were kept on changing the format to try and make more of a match of it. And but in 77 particularly, Tom Weisskopf got qualified to play for America. And he decided that it wasn't worth the trip, you know. And he went shooting in Alaska. And that prompted, actually, Jack to write to Lord Derby, who was the president of the PGA, British PGA at the time, and suggesting that they bring Europe into the fray and to try and even the odds. And they did. That's what they did. You know, I mean, they European players came in. That being said, there was only two from Spain represented in that 79 match. It was Antonio Garrido and, of course, Seve. And I think it's fair to say that, you know, I mean, they got the greens so quick at the Greek. They were cutting them twice a day and polishing them at night, I think. They were lightning fast, and we got well beaten. And, you know, Seve wasn't firing on all cylinders, although that was the year he won the Open in 79 from the car park, if you remember, at Lytham.
Oh, sure.
But we still got sort of well beat, and but that was the beginning of you know, a real surge from the European end. Through the 80s, of course, I think it's fair to say we dominated from 85, well, and through the 90s. So the 2000s, I mean, it was big changes. We had a lot of great players come on stream, and you know who they are as well as I do. You know, it's, you know, Woosnam and Langer, Laspel, Faldo and Lau were already there with Seve, and we were very strong. You know, we got it done a few times.
You did.
Well, it's a thrill to be joined by World Cup Hall of Fame member Tony Jacklin here on Musings on Golf. My final question to you, Tony, what did it mean to you to be a first-time Ryder Cup captain in 1983 in the Ryder Cup that was held at PGA National in Florida?
Well, you know, obviously it was a great honor, but it wasn't all plain sailing getting there. There was a lot of dissension, a lot of officialdom was arguing behind the scenes about who the captain should be. Historically, the captain had always been sort of 20 years older than the team members. And it wasn't working out very well. And Bernard Langer I found out years later, was pushing for somebody who was still in touch with what the players were doing. And and that, you know, they pointed that towards me. And but unfortunately, they didn't make the decision until sort of 6 months before the matches, which meant I didn't get any captain's picks in 83. And also, I was a bit sort of disgruntled at being left out of the team in 81. I was sort of 12th or 13th in the money list, and they overlooked me. And Seve had been banned in 81, and he was arguably the best player in the world. So there was a lot going on in European golf that a lot of people didn't know much about. And so I was pretty teed off, as I say, when they asked me. And I'd recognised some of the things that I thought needed to be done to make us more competitive. And I said I would do it but I would only do it on my own terms. And so they gave me, at the end of the day, I got carte blanche to do what I wanted. And, you know, that meant travelling first class instead of at the back of the bus where we always were. Officialdom was organising all this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they weren't players. It was, you know, the secretary of the PGA or whoever. We were wearing clothing that we wasn't very good. It was anything anybody would give us, we wore, basically. We didn't have a team room at the time. I created the team room in 83 for the first time, where that was just privy to the players and wives. That's it. That was it. I never asked for anything that Americans weren't already getting. They were traveling first class all the time. We never traveled with our caddies, for example, in the 60s. I mean, in Houston and in St. Louis in the early 70s, we didn't have our caddies with us because they couldn't afford to fly them out there. And so we got all those essential things taken care of. I thought they were essential from a self-esteem point of view. And once that was all taken care of, the players started to respond in a very positive way. And it linked in with this surge of, you know, European talent coming on. Alassabell and Langer won their Masters tournaments in the mid-80s. And Lyle was, you know, a great player at that time as well. A lot of them were playing on the American tour as well. So it was all good. I mean, we came very, very close in 83. And I think it's fair to say, you can point at 83 to say, I mean, we were gutted that we didn't win. We lost by a single point. And I think it was Seve, you know, who said, you know, hey, don't be so sad. You know, this is the best we've ever done in America. And it was a real turning point. And of course, we took the confidence gain from that and managed to win in front of the home crowd in 1985 at the Belfry.
Were it not for Lanny Watkins' terrific third shot on the 18th hole in that final match in 83, the outcome may have been different. And at PGA National, obviously the U.S. held on, as you said. But when you won in 85 at the Belfry, it ended a very long losing streak for the Europeans. What was how do you put that into words? What was that like to finally take that Ryder Cup into possession?
Well, it was it was unbelievable. I mean, the amazing thing was we actually were behind after I think the first day. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't sort of hit the ground running as we thought we might, but in all Ryder Cups, the ebb and flow of you know, the advantage is always there. And Craig Stadler actually missed a little putt on the last green in the second day, and I mean, it was a short. I mean, it was no more than 18 inches, 2 feet, certainly. And the momentum swung back to us on that point. And, you know, we carried it through. And I can still I can still see. In fact, I was out over at the Belfry a couple of months ago, and I never go there without looking up on the roof, and we were all up on the roof celebrating. Champagne was flowing, but it was pretty euphoric. I mean, for us to win that thing. But little did we know it was the precursor for, you know, for winning it. At Milford Village was it. I mean, winning in America for the first time was really, that was when we really knew that, you know, we had it going in the right direction. I mean, it was a tremendous effort there.
Winning it at Muirfield Village in 87 at Jack's Course in the United States, in a sense, did that almost eclipse? Was it almost at a higher level winning in the States than winning 2 years earlier at the Belfry?
Yeah, I mean, it was ironic, really, I suppose. I mean, having had the experience of the concession in 69 against Jack, that he would be the American captain, and it was in his own backyard, as it were. And one has to say, you know, he took it. He was just amazing. I think, in fairness to him, he was probably, you know, as a losing captain on that occasion, and he was big enough that it was never going to affect his career anyway, and he took it on the chin, as you would expect him to do. He was a great sport about it, and but it was at the top of the shop as far as we were concerned. I mean, we really felt like, not that it needed vindication, but the changes that I made in 93, the fundamental changes to give the players more self-esteem going into the thing, had done the trick, really, and worked. And to the point, actually, in 89, which was my last year as captain, I mean, we all the stars lost on Sunday. I mean, Seve lost, Faldo lost, Wisdom lost in the singles, but it was the likes of Ronan Rafferty and Christy O'Connor Jr. that carried the day. You know, that two iron of Christy's on the last hole against Fred Couples was unforgettable. And to wriggle out of that as we did with a tie and retain the thing was it heralded the time for me to go. Anyway, I felt that I'd done my bit. We'd won home and away, and I say got the half by the skin of our teeth, and it was time to go. And it's ironic, but in those days, I mean, there was no actual obvious successor, you know. But Bernard Gallagher had sat with me and been my sort of right hand man for three of the four times I capped, and you know, I made the suggestion that he should do it going forward, which of course he did.
Was by 89, it had been four straight for you as captain. Was the gasoline tank kind of empty for you at that point? No. That seems like that's eight long years, and I would imagine in a positive way, but that's a long, long time.
Yeah, it was a long time, but I loved it. I loved doing it.
Yeah,
but there's an irony here. It was during that period that Margaret Thatcher was in power in England, and I'd seen what happened to her. You know, I thought she did a hell of a job. She was, you know, fighting a lot of different things during that period. And people that were very close to her started sort of stabbing her in the back. And I didn't want to outstay my welcome. I'd had a wonderful 4 years at it. I loved it. I loved doing the pairings and trying to outwit the opposite captain with positioning players in the field and doing all the rest of it. But I think, you know, I just felt it would have been self-indulgent to continue. And I wanted to leave on a high note. I didn't want players saying, oh, Jacqueline's, you know, it's time he cleared off. And I went on my own accord, and because I thought it was the right thing to do. And have I regretted it? Not really. I think I did the right thing by doing that.
Tony, I know that Bob has a couple final questions to ask of you. Final question for me, and you just mentioned it as far as the pairings and so forth. It's a whirlwind 3 days, right? When it starts on Friday morning and through Sunday evening, and there's so much that goes into it. In terms of the pairings that you set, and then decisions that you made after the morning session on Friday leading into the afternoon session, et cetera, what were the toughest challenges? Were those the toughest pairings, say, for the afternoon, who to sit? Because you always had to sit four players. And that can't be easy.
Yeah, it happens at warp speed, as you say. I mean, once you get to Friday morning, it's you're really sinking on your feet the whole time. And it's interesting because the first two times I did it, I leant very heavily on the major winners, on the star players. And I said to them, get plenty of rest this week because you're not going to get any once Friday morning comes. You know, I told other players that you might not play till Sunday. I can't remember. But, I had no option but to try and make the strongest pairings I could. And I always gave the major winners, you know, a lot of credit in terms of, you know, if they had the mental capacity to knock a major off, then, you know, they were well equipped to play, you know, for the pressure that a Ryder Cup has. So, yeah, I mean... to be honest, you pray a lot too. You become a lot closer to God during that those few days, because once you've made the pairings, you're done. I mean, and it's in the lap of the gods. And match play is a totally different animal. They're getting the team mm-hmm. by stroke play. In other words, they're getting the team by playing careful golf. But in match play, you can go for broke, you know. It doesn't matter if you take an 8 or a 10, you just lose the hole. So you're firing at pins all the time and taking risks that you probably wouldn't take on a normal basis. And so your antennae are out all the time as a captain. You're looking, you're listening to everything everybody says. You're watching body language all the time, just to monitoring this, monitoring that. And but it was fun for me to do. I enjoyed it. I didn't get much sleep, but I enjoyed doing it.
Tony, final question for me. In your opinion, what are the keys to the Ryder Cup this week in Italy? And who do you see emerging with that trophy on Sunday? And any particular feelings either way?
Well, I have to say that, you know, after the sort of drubbing we got last time in Wisconsin, and it was an odd, you know, with COVID, spectators weren't traveling. I don't think Europe got the support they might have had on a normal basis, but also a lot of older players were on that European side. This time around, I really have to say I like the look of the team. We've got Luke Donald, who's all the experience in the world. The only experience he hasn't had is losing a Ryder Cup, and I hope that doesn't change in Rome for him. But we've got, you know, the likes of Åberg and the young Dane on the team. We've got, obviously, Rory's there. You've got the likes of Rahm and Fleetwood. I like the look of it. And again, it's a dilemma for Luke. Which way to go, you know, early on, because ideally you like to get the lead early and then you get the galleries behind you. And I think the galleries will certainly, if Europe get ahead early on, the galleries will be behind the European team. So I'm obviously pulling for Europe, but like I say, it goes at warp speed once Friday morning's there, and it all happens very quickly. So we'll see. I'm sure we'll get a lot of thrills, and you can't make book on some of the finishes that we've enjoyed over the years at Ryder Cups, and I'm looking forward to it very much.
Well, final, just a follow-up. Does it ultimately come down to who makes the most putts in the Ryder Cup, or is it more nuanced? Is it more complicated than that?
I don't know much about the golf course, I have to say. It's been purpose-built. I've heard it's very hilly, and there's a lot of dog legs. Now, I don't know whether Luke's going to... I mean, a few years ago at Hazeltine, I remember Davis Love, the captain, put a lot all the pins in the middle of the greens because he thought that was an advantage to his home side, and it worked for him. Now, whether Luke's got anything up his sleeve, I don't know how long the rough is, whether he's gone for narrow fairways and accuracy. And historically, again, recently, the American captains have gone for sort of very little rough because they've got bombers on their team. But there's bombers on both teams now. So it's going to be interesting. I got the rough around the greens cut down at the Belfry the first time we went there in 85. Because I thought maybe the American players were more used to that sort of long rough around the greens. But now they're all playing all over the world. So their experiences as players are pretty equal. So I'm not sure that there's any advantage in the course setup anymore. But again, one of the things we'll see.
Well, we enjoyed having you, Tony Jacklin. When I think back to our... what our listeners got a piece of. We got to talk about Jack Nicklaus. We got to talk about Arnold Palmer. We got to talk about Tony Jacklin, Seve Ballesteros, and Feitzing on the cake. We even got to talk about God. Thank you, Tony Jacklin, for being on Musings on Golf. You're a wonderful ambassador for the sport. And on behalf of Kelly Elbin, Bob Bupka saying, thank you, Tony.
My pleasure, Bob. Nice to see you.
When you make the best performing golf balls in the world, your biggest competition is yourself. And now the golf ball that sets the standard for every other has raised the bar again. New Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X are longer and more consistent with unrivaled control. Outperform with new Pro V1 and Pro V1X. Titleist. The number one ball in golf.
Bob, you know, you hear someone like Tony Jacklin, and it really speaks to leadership. He was, the story about Jack Nicklaus conceding the putt is certainly well known in 1969 Ryder Cup. But the leadership from Tony Jacklin for an entire continent and the pressure that came with it is something of Ryder Cup lore.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the one thing about Tony Jacklin, and I've had the pleasure of knowing him for a good number of years, I can't think of probably a greater ambassador for the sport of golf than Tony Jacklin. Not only what he accomplished while he was playing, but as a Ryder Cup captain, and really changing the face of the Ryder Cup to where now it's no easy pick. To see who's going to win. One quick thing, Kelly. People ask me how much the Ryder Cup has changed over the years. Well, I can remember way back when they would have an assistant captain that was responsible for having towels ready for their players. Now, that assistant captain that is in charge of getting the towels has an assistant captain getting him the towels before he gets the towels to the players. I mean, it's just mind-boggling how much detail they go into.
Well, we'll see which side waves the white towel Sunday night. We really appreciate Captain Tony Jacklin joining us here on Musings on Golf. Hope everyone enjoys the three spectacular days in Rome on USA Network Peacock, and then the majority of it on NBC Sports. Next week, the great Jeff Rude, longtime golf columnist, golf writer for Golf Week, one of the great golf writers in our country, will be here to recap. And you talk about a guy with some great stories, including one about scaling the cemetery at St. Andrews on a recent trip of a lifetime, Bob.
Yeah, Jeff Rude, class act for years, certainly the dean of golf writers in America, a good friend, good entertainment. He has a sharp wit, and I already excited about hearing how he describes what transpires here in Italy.
For my good friend, Bob Bupka, Kelly Elbin signing off, wishing all of you a great Ryder Cup weekend, no matter the results. And thanks for listening to Musings on Golf.